From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Shira Springer. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, it's going to be a cold weekend.
I think the forecast could actually dip below zero on New Year's Eve.
That made us think ice sculptures. Also today, the year in food, and whether the calling out of misconduct in the kitchen will really change restaurant culture.
To stay silent has a real cost. I think the reality of the situation in this rapidly changing field is that people will be forced to do the right thing.
Plus, an update on the head of the MBTA. And the New Yorker's poetry editor joins us to talk about his new book. It's all about hoaxes and fake news.
The danger is what I call a half-hoax world, where nothing is really quite ever true. Everything is just a little bit fake, and that can start to seem pervasive.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Shira Springer. It's another bitterly cold day in Boston. With the wind chill factored in, it feels like it's minus 2 degrees outside, and there's no immediate relief in sight. For more, we're joined now by WBUR meteorologist David Epstein via Skype. David, thanks for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome.
Now, it's a sad state of affairs when it feels like minus 2 degrees outside, and it actually seems like a slight warm-up from yesterday. But how much longer until we get a real warm-up?
It's going to be a while. I think that people are going to have to kind of be reticent to the fact that this is going to be how we are going to start the beginning of January. It's definitely going through the first week. There's a good likelihood we're going to go into the second week of January in the same sort of regime. So I think you have to just make peace with this and kind of do your best to get through it and enjoy it and embrace it. And like you said, on a day like today with light winds and some sunshine, go take a walk.
Okay, and layer up if you do take a walk.
Yeah, layer up, hats, gloves, all that stuff.
Face mask, goggles, the whole nine yards. What will this weekend look like for folks who want to go out and about and celebrate the new year?
Right. So tomorrow, if you think today felt mild, tomorrow's going to be spring-like. You'll be in shorts because temperatures are going to be, you know, close to 20. And when
balmy.
You consider that it's been feeling like minus 10, that's a 30-degree flip. So literally outside tomorrow, it will feel a bit better. We are going to have a little bit of snow. There's a storm system that's going to miss us. About a week ago, it looked like we could see a potential snowstorm tomorrow. But, you know, as the models get more refined and closer to the actual date, we see what's really going to happen. And that's just some clouds and a little light snow. It could be 1 to 3 inches Cape Cod in the islands. In Boston, maybe a coating, but also maybe nothing since we're right on the northern fringe. And then for Saturday night, everything clears out. It starts getting windy again. Temperatures fall back down to the single digits. Sunday's a cold day. If you're headed to the Patriots game or are going to be outside, only around 15 degrees, those winds will be gusty. So at times that wind chill going down to minus 15 again, when you hear those numbers, it's not the entire time. It's real bursts of that cold air with the wind. Then New Year's Eve, temperatures get down probably around 1 or 2 degrees around midnight in Boston. With the wind, you're definitely going to want to be bundled up. You'll want to have, you know, maybe some foot warmers and hand warmers and things like that. And then New Year's Day, only near 10, but plenty of sunshine. That's a very cold day, very similar to yesterday.
Okay, so the best advice is get those hand warmers out, get layer up, just bundle up as best you can to brace yourself against the wind and the chill.
That's right. Scarves are really great. The hand warmers are wonderful if you're going to be outside for an extended period of time. They last several hours, and they're really not that expensive either, which is a good way to kind of keep your fingertips warm, especially if you're going to be doing a hike or snowshoeing or cross-country skiing or anything like that.
Or even just sitting outside at the Patriots game, right?
That's, yeah. Sitting is hard because you're not using the energy that kind of keeps your body warm, so you actually feel really cold sitting. And I know Gillette does allow blankets, so a nice fleece blanket would be also a good thing to keep some of the heat in.
All right. That's WBUR meteorologist David Epstein joining us via Skype. David, thanks for joining us and stay warm yourself.
Happy New Year.
So we know it will be cold this weekend, but if you still feel like enjoying some of Boston's best sights and sounds, you're in luck. First Night is still on. Joining us to talk about what's in store for this year's First Night festivities is Dusty Rhodes, the organizer of First Night and the president of Conventures, a Boston-based event planning and marketing firm. Dusty, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
So tell me what's in store for this year's First Night. What do you expect will attract the largest crowds?
Well, let's put it this way. The ice sculptures are very happy.
I can imagine that with this weather, yes.
This is probably the best year for the ice sculptures. And we've got about 11 magnificent, huge ones. Our theme is Enchanted Forest. And I'm at in Copley Square right now watching the beginnings of those ice sculptures arrive here.
Now, you personally, what are you most excited about?
The families and the kids and the little kids all bundled up in their strollers that come down and see these magnificent ice sculptures and the lighting and seeing our city take advantage of the things that we already have. We have the beautiful, iconic buildings of Copley Square lit. They're facially lit. So they're so beautiful. And I don't think people realize how gorgeous our architecture is.
Now, for the first time this year, there's going to be a first night scavenger hunt. Can you tell us about that? How's that going to work?
Well, that's part of the new social media, and it's been going on for a few weeks. And it's a fun way of getting the whole family involved to go find out where the secrets are, to post them, to tell other people. And, modest prizes, but prizes nonetheless. So it's a way of getting the entire family involved.
And this is something people will be able to do with their mobile phones.
Exactly. Go to firstnightboston.org, and you'll see the scavenger hunt right there.
Now, at a First Night press conference earlier today, Police Commissioner Evans spoke about the security precautions that will be put in place during First Night, including having police officers stationed on rooftops. Here's what he said.
Unfortunately, that's a new reality today, that not only do we need the public's eyes on the ground, but we need to have some observation from up above.
So what else is going to be done to make sure the events of First Night are safe for everyone who's coming to enjoy them?
Well, being involved with many major events in the city, the BPD, Boston Police Department, is magnificent in their execution. So, for example, the sand trucks or snowplows that might be positioned at strategic intersections. That'll happen almost surreptitiously. You won't even see it happen, but it appears and it makes the whole compound, particularly Copley Square, a very secure environment for families and people to come to.
Now, weather-wise, we've heard from city officials that the high winds might impact the fireworks. Is that a big concern at this moment? And could the weather affect any scheduling of events?
The weather could, and the public safety officials leave that option open to them, as the mayor said today. Basically, your fireworks over Boston Harbor at midnight would be the least affected because they're not ground-based. The fireworks at 7 o'clock in the Common are subject to extreme high winds, which right now we don't anticipate. And the pyrotechnology or the light show at the Copley on Countdown at midnight in Copley Square, right now it looks pretty secure.
All right, that's Dusty Rhodes. She's the organizer for Boston's First Night and the president of Conventures. Thanks for joining us, Dusty.
Thank you for having us.
And First Night events are free and will take place around Boston on Sunday, December 31st and Monday, January 1st. Now, one of my favorite parts of First Night is the ice sculptures, as Dusty mentioned. They're a real highlight. Joining us today is the artist behind two of the ice sculptures you can see around Boston this weekend, Don Chappelle. Don is the founder of Brilliant Ice Sculptures. Thanks for joining us, Don.
Hi, Sherry. Thanks for having us.
Now, you finished one sculpture, a blue lobster, outside of the aquarium, and you're outside right now on Boylston Street crafting, let me get this right, an 18-ton ice sculpture? How's that going?
Well, it's actually going quite well. It's going quite swimmingly. It's quite cold, and things are moving along quickly.
So that's good. That's good for you. Like things to be. This is like the perfect temperature for your work, right?
Well, it's not perfect. It's a little cold, but I'll take it. I think the last time it was this cold was 1994.
Now, just tell me, how did you originally get into making ice sculptures? It seems like a very unique profession.
Well, I was a chef for 33 years, and I used to moonlight at a ice house in Brookline and do ice sculpture. I used to create ice sculptures after I got out of work, and I did that. I've been actually sculpting ice since I was 18, so I'm 59 now. You can do the math on that. So, it takes a good 20 years before you can actually make a dollar at it, and we actually have a very thriving business at Brilliant Ice Sculpture. So, things are well.
Do you specialize in any particular type of sculpture? Or do you have a particular, preference for the type of ice sculptures you like to do? Do you love to do these massive 18-ton sculptures, or do you like to work more intricately?
Yeah, I think, well, we do actually, on our website, we have some drink luges that are absolutely amazing. I think the best in the world. I don't think anyone's doing them like we are. So that's quite interesting, a drink luge. But I do love, like I say, I've been doing it First Night Boston for, I don't know, 28 years. And I just love the big sculptures in downtown Boston. It's so wonderful. It's a great community give back. And it's a way to express your artistic talents on a large scale.
So I'm curious, when it comes to these big 18-ton sculptures, how does that work? Do you sculpt part of them off-site and then bring them in blocks to the site and kind of, you know, put them together on-site? Or do you do all of the work on-site on Boylston Street by the aquarium? I mean, how do you manage such a large ice sculpture?
All right, so we make about 80% of the ice that we can use. We can't manufacture all of it, and we purchase what we call base block. It's C block. It's not perfect. It says impurities, but you don't see it. And so there's about 4 tons right there, and we've already laid the base block down, and that's something we don't do at the studio. But the piece at the aquarium, the blue lobster, and the piece at 880 Boylston. Most of it we made at this. I was like 80-90% of it was made at the studio, and we just shipped it in.
They
shipped it in modularly, so basically it goes together in pieces.
Gotcha. So you put it together on site, and you do some of the crafting.
It's the safest way to move these things. Yeah.
Gotcha. And now you've also dabbled in making sculptures out of butter and chocolate, right? So how is that different from working in ice?
Well, what I work for Hilton International in Geneva. Geneva, Switzerland, and Vienna, Austria, and you had it. And I actually worked in these one Michelin star restaurants, and you couldn't get a visa to get a visa to work in the EU. You had to do something that a European couldn't do. So I was a sculptor. So they hired me to do ice sculptures, butter sculptures, and chocolate sculptures during the day, and at night I'd work in these one Michelin star restaurants. So it was a perfect win-win situation all the way around.
And now, do you have a favorite ice sculpture that you've made in the past, something that really sticks out in your mind?
Yeah. I mean, I have a bunch of favorites. I think the dragon piece we did in 2014 was right down in Trinity Place. That was fantastic. One of my favorites is a piece called Whale Pods. Even though whales don't travel in pods. It's a misnomer. But, yeah, that was in front of the Boston Public Library. That was 64 feet long and 23 feet tall. That was amazing.
And just how long does it take you to craft something like that? I mean, these massive pieces.
I was a lot younger then. I actually I had a lot of help building it, but I sculpted it all myself. So it was,
Is it weeks? Does it take weeks to sculpt these things, massive?
No, I did it in 4 days.
Oh, wow. That seems awfully fast.
It moves quick. Ice cuts quickly. We use these beautiful high-carbon Japanese steel chisels and really good quality chainsaws, and you can rip right through the stuff. So it's basically you get all the negative space off of what you want, and then the fine detail, that goes quick as well.
So, all right, it takes you only 4 days to craft these ice sculptures, but still, does it bother you to see those sculptures that you spent so much time on just melting away or maybe, I don't know, floating down the Charles River,
yeah.
Done seeing them?
Sounds like you were a first night organizer at one time. So no, it doesn't bother me at all, and it never has bothered me. All you need to do is grab a few really good pictures, and those are memories for life.
That sounds fantastic. Well, if you want to see Don Chappelle's ice sculptures, you can head down to Copley Square. Don Chappelle is the founder of Brilliant Ice Sculptures. Again, you can see his work around Boston this weekend. Thanks for joining us, and glad the weather is working out for someone.
Well, thank you so much, Sherry. It's been great talking with you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Shira Springer, and this is Radio Boston. The year in food started innocently enough. There was the popularity of pokey, the rise of meatless meatballs, newfound love of bread making, and Amazon entering the grocery store business. Then came the allegations of sexual harassment against celebrity chef John Besh. Earlier today, the New Orleans Times-Picayune reported that two more sexual harassment complaints have been filed against Besh. That brings the total number of women who have filed federal complaints to four. Besh brought the Me Too movement to the restaurant industry. Since Besh, other celebrity chefs have faced accusations of sexual misconduct, including Todd English and Mario Batali, who both have restaurants in the Boston area. Corby Kummer joins us now to talk about the year in food. He's a James Beard Award-winning food writer, senior editor at The Atlantic, and restaurant critic for Boston Magazine. Corby, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Oh, sure. I'm so glad to be with you.
Now, Corby, in addition to the federal complaints against Besh, 25 women came forward claiming sexual harassment in his restaurant's kitchens, and four women have accused Mario Batali of touching them inappropriately. Were you surprised by the number of allegations made against these celebrity chefs?
It's the bravery of the women that I have to think about. I'm a longtime pal of the New Orleans Times-Picayune reporter who broke the Besh story. And he had told me about the women coming forward last spring, and I'd strongly encourage him to write it because I knew this was really important in the restaurant industry, and there was so much more where that came from. It happened to run 10 days after the Harvey Weinstein story in the New York Times, and I assumed the women had decided to go on the record because of that Weinstein story, but not that. It was that it was so hard to get these women to go on the record, period, and then to get the restaurant to reply. With all these stories, what you read may look similar to the other stories that have gone before, but each one involves individual bravery on the women, deciding they will name themselves, they will file complaints, as two more did today, and Brett reported in the New Orleans Times-Picayune against Besh. And then there's lots of just kind of gross behavior, which is, I think, what we saw with Mario Batali.
Mm-hmm. Now, Besh has stepped down from the restaurant group he owns in New Orleans, and Batali apologized and stepped away from the day-to-day operations of his restaurant empire. Is that enough? I mean, is that going to precipitate real change in the restaurant industry?
You know, who knows? I hope it will. One of the worst stories was reported beautifully by Kim Severson and Julia Moskin in the New York Times. That was about a restaurateur, an owner in New York named Ken Friedman. And he owns something called the Spotted Pig. And one of the complexities of this story is the woman, April Bloomfield, who is co-owner with him, is one of the leaders in the industry. She's married to a woman proudly. She's a woman, a very successful woman in the restaurant business. And in the story, she was quoted as telling woman after woman, complaining about the owner, the male owner. You know, that's Ken being Ken, which is the typical reply about how so many people turn blind eyes to this. So will it change? I think that the first thing that has to change is having someone to complain to at these restaurants. They're very small businesses. They're often owned by chefs who never had any experience running a business. So how to handle personnel, how to handle complaints, how to handle the kind of liberty and entitlement that comes with being an owner and a boss, which is what we're seeing in these stories, is all new. So I hope that there's, I don't know, a new class of consultants who tell these owners and chefs how they're supposed to treat personnel.
Yeah, and I also think it's going to take not only, you know, food journalists and some of the lesser known chefs speaking out about this, but perhaps some of the more well-known chefs speaking out about it. And we haven't really seen that.
Glad you mentioned this and sorry to interrupt, because I tweeted Brett's story five separate times, more than I've ever tweeted a story, as soon as it came out in October, the third week of October. And I got so little pickup on Twitter, really unusual, just this very morning with the new John Besh allegations and a kind of horrifying story about a very good chef in Oakland, California, right across the bay from San Francisco and next to Berkeley, about a guy named Charlie Hallowell who stepped aside because he's done so many really gross out inappropriate things with women over the years. Again, fell dead people don't seem to want to read this. Tom Colicchio is the one high-profile male chef who really came out and did some soul-searching, not for himself, but saying this is a fault of the industry and the industry has to change.
And before we move on to the actual trends of 2017, I want to make one last point on this subject, and that's that, you know, the celebrity chefs and what they were accused of sort of dominated the news as far as kitchens go, but sexual harassment is widespread in the restaurant industry, and it's also in chain restaurants and fast food establishments. And some food service workers told The Washington Post they basically accept harassment as part of the job. Is sexual harassment even more prevalent in these chain and fast food restaurants?
I think it is. And I'm so glad you were listening to my dinner conversation last night. Imagine how cheerful it was. It was about exactly this subject. And a brilliant piece by Tracy McMillan. She wrote The American Way of Eating about essentially what the toll the food system takes on the poor people who, literally poor people and illegal immigrants who work in these restaurants and work in the fields. And she, Tracy McMillan, did both for this really good book. One of them was working in Applebee's. There was a very, you know, semi-grueling chapter in The American Way of Eating about working in Applebee's, but it did not include a story that Tracy wrote about in the New York Times op-ed section after the Weinstein case, in which she talked about her goodbye party at Applebee's. It was after she'd worked in the kitchen at Applebee's. A woman on the line in a fast casual restaurant, or a family restaurant, really, who was subjected to a lot of remarks and a lot of harassment. She had a thick skin and she could give it back verbally as well as she got it. And so she thought she was fine. And then at her goodbye party, which was surrounded by a couple of guys she thought had her back, she was drugged, slipped a drink, and woke up realizing she had been raped in somebody else's room. And the betrayal from the colleagues she had made, who she thought would be her friends, and the idea that nobody stopped it and they were all watching it was really horrifying, and I think brought home the idea this isn't just high-profile celebrity chefs. This is every place in the restaurant business.
We're talking about the year in food with Corby Kummer. He's a James Beard Award-winning food writer, senior editor at The Atlantic, and restaurant critic for Boston Magazine. Let's move into the food trends from 2017. You wrote, at least in the cookbook world, that Americans are rediscovering a love of bread and bread baking, right? And Radio Boston actually spoke with Nathan Myhrvold about his book, Modernist Bread, which he said was about more than just baking bread, but also the science behind it, and answering questions like this.
When hot bread comes out of the oven, it's just awesome. Yeah. It smells so damn good. Why does it smell so damn good to us? That was one of the questions.
A mix of science and food. Was this what made Myhrvold's Modernist Bread cookbook so unique and stand out to you?
Well, I did a roundup of what I thought were the best food books of the year for The Atlantic. And I put his first. And it's five volumes and it costs $535. Why would I do such a crazy thing?
Yeah, why?
Because reading it, you see on the page, did you hear that enthusiasm in Nathan's voice? I know him. He invited me out and I saw the kitchens when they were doing the book. He's an overgrown little boy who's curious about the world. He loves it. He wants to find out everything and tell you about it. And he assembles a team that has this way of doing essentially an illustrated encyclopedia of everything to do with grains. You learn a tremendous amount about grains. And so one of the things I said in the roundup was, it's just fine if you don't eat gluten. There's so much about what do we know about gluten intolerance? What does it do to you? What do we know about the digestion of grains, about growing them? He's such an overgrown little boy that he recreated a Roman fresco from Pompeii of a bread store.
Now, speaking of grains, last year we saw grain bowls. They were the big thing in food. This year, it seems like that title belongs to the Hawaiian raw fish salad, the Poke Bowl. It seemed to pop up everywhere. What do you think of the pokey trend?
I think that people like the name. I think it's a cross between tartare and, you know, tuna tartare, which sounds a little pretentious, and sushi, which everybody loves. Plus, it's got a lot of spices and herbs chopped up with it. So it's easy to have. It doesn't really taste like raw fish because it's got so many sauces going on in it. And I don't think it's going to last. I think it's, you know, silly that people will decide whether they like sushis or salad, and they'll go back to those things. But it's fine, and it's cute, and it's like bubble tea. Suddenly it's everywhere, and then it's kind of nowhere.
All right. Also this year, the meatless meatball debuted at the Clover Food Labs. The meatball was the creation of Impossible Foods, a company based in California, and was exclusive to Clover. Impossible Meats advertises its quote-unquote beef as meat that bleeds, but it's entirely plant-based. First of all, Corby, have you tried this meatless meatball sub at Clover? And if so, what did you think?
So I think I'm the only person who has convinced the two people named Brown who are unrelated to each other and are somewhat bitter rivals and both make plant-based burgers, Impossible Foods, Pat Brown, a molecular biologist from Palo Alto at Stanford, and Ethan Brown, this really good, straight-ahead environmentalist guy, who makes Beyond Meat, which you can get in the freezer case and the fresh meat case of Whole Foods and other supermarkets, to sample their burgers in the same tent across from each other at the Aspen Ideas Festival two summers ago. So I'm one of the few people who's eaten them side by side.
So what did you think? What did you think?
That I much preferred Beyond Meat, that it's more versatile, it has less of a greasy after flavor. They each have things that are red in them to make you think they are bleeding, even though, you know, neither one is blood. And this heme molecule that Patrick Brown has done for Impossible Foods gets so much mileage out of it, but it doesn't add any discernible meat flavor to me. The reason people are kind of turning somersaults and jumping up and down about this is because it's so cleverly marketed. So he began with a chef named Tracy Desjardins in San Francisco, and then David Chang of Momofuku, the empire in New York. So you had to go down. You had to line up. You had to wait to get it. And it was slathered in so many highly flavored sauces, you really had no idea what it tasted like.
Got it.
And you still don't.
Okay, so let's move on to the restaurant scene in Boston this year. Any big changes that you want to draw our attention to? And we're kind of have to wrap this up quickly.
There were more closings than there were openings. So for openings, Waypoint, a big bistro pizzeria by the really gifted, abundantly gifted chef Michael Shelfo in Cambridge of Alden and Harlow. And that's in sort of Putnam Square between Central and Harvard in Cambridge. Really fun place, really great vibe to it. Terra, the third floor restaurant at Eataly, which is very good, kind of straight ahead, fresh farm to table style Italian food. But the closings were really notable. So there was Blue Ginger in Wellesley. Ming Tsai has Blue Dragon in Fort Point Channel. He's gone to Fast Casual. He's opening a new place called Chow Stirs. East Coast Grill, the one that I personally mourn the most. It meant so much to Boston and Cambridge, both in terms of barbecue, service, grilled fish, a kind of vibrant, casual approach to eating. That's a really incalculable loss. It's now Highland Fried, so there's fried food in the same location if you want that. And then some quirky places that I'll really miss. Fairstead Kitchen in Washington Square, Cambridge, which was just a delightful, odd neighborhood place. It's reopening under the same ownership as Grassona Italian, so I'll look forward to that. Fireplace, where Five Seasons was, very nearby in Washington Square, Cambridge. You know, when places take hold in a neighborhood, you really just wish them well and want them to be there forever, but nothing's forever, especially in restaurants.
Got
Journeyman,
it.
A tasting menu.
Okay, I think we've got enough of the restaurants, and I think on one last note, you know, we have to just mention the Amazon takeover of Whole Foods. The online retailer spent over $13 billion on the upmarket grocery store chain, leading to a lot of talk about how Amazon could change the future of grocery stores, and I think in many ways the future of food. Looking to 2018 and beyond, in 15 seconds, how is the Amazon acquisition going to change the future of food?
home delivery was a big trend, and lots of well-funded places are going under. So Amazon's clobbered it. What happens with home delivery will all be in the hands of Amazon and Whole Foods, but maybe we're going to have to go to the store, see each other, and be nice to people who wait on us, which I'd like a lot.
All right, terrific. That's Corby Kummer, James Beard Award-winning food writer, senior editor at The Atlantic, and restaurant critic for Boston Magazine. Thank you again for joining us, and Happy New Year.
And to you.
Since August, Radio Boston has been looking into the business background of the new head of the MBTA, Luis Ramirez. He's been praised as a turnaround specialist by Governor Baker, but a Radio Boston analysis of federal securities filings in August shows that the Texas company Ramirez claims to have turned around is dealing with wide-ranging financial problems as a result of issues under his tenure. Shareholders of Global Power Equipment Group had filed a class action lawsuit against Ramirez last May. They alleged he violated federal securities laws while he was CEO. Radio Boston's Meghna Chakrabarty has been following this story, and she joins us now. Hi, Meghna.
Hi. You know, I have to say, I'm glad to be in here. Your conversation with Corby Kummer was making me so hungry.
Likewise. We'll have to go out and grab something after this.
Let's talk about something to kill our appetites. That's, I guess the tea would do.
Yes, because we'll never get to wherever we're going.
Exactly.
On the tea. You have an update on the lawsuit. What's been going on?
Okay, so as you said, Luis Ramirez, at his last sort of major post at Global Power in Texas, when he was CEO there, after he left in 2015, the company basically tanked, and so shareholders sued him in a class action lawsuit. And the thing about a class action lawsuit for securities violations is that you have to prove in your complaint intent. And just this week, a federal judge in Texas dismissed the class action because she said that in their claim, the plaintiffs did not prove that Luis Ramirez had any intent to mismanage finances at Global Power. So the lawsuit has been dismissed, although the judge did give them an opportunity to maybe refile by January 15th.
So just curious, what's the MBTA saying about all of this?
Nothing. I reached out to them. They have no comment.
And is a dismissal like this unusual?
No, actually, there was a company called NERA Economic Analysis. They're a consultancy. And they did this look at class action, securities class actions between 2000 and 2016 and found that basically 70% of them get dismissed. And part of the reason why, it's for a bunch of reasons. I mean, some of the suits don't really have standing. But the real issue, I think, is that it's really hard to prove intent when it comes to financial mismanagement. You have to sort of show from evidence that there is some indication that managers knew what they were doing that led to securities violation, and that's not easy to do.
And also, we mentioned some of the controversy over his performance as CEO of his last company, Global Power.
Yep.
Can you remind us a little bit about what happened there? Because that was also, I think, cited in the lawsuit.
Yeah, it's the
right?
source of the lawsuit. It's the heart of the lawsuit. So basically what happened was when Ramirez was CEO of Global Power, again, this Texas company, for several years, it turns out that they filed erroneous financial statements to the SEC. That's a big, big no-no, right? Because all shareholders require those financial statements to be accurate. And just after Ramirez left, and by the way, you have to, as you remember, CEOs have to sign those financial statements certifying their accuracy. So just after he left, the company announced, just after his resignation, that they would have to refile corrected financial statements. Now, the reason why they had to do that was what was being fought out in this lawsuit. But again, that lawsuit has been dismissed.
And now, quickly, there's another investigation going on by the SEC right now. What's the status of that investigation, and what could that mean for Ramirez's future?
Yeah, so the SEC is also looking into Global Power's financial filings, but they don't ever talk about any inquiry that's going on, so we don't know what the status is of that.
So much more digging to do on all of this.
Yeah, so it's still an open question.
That's Meghna Chakrabarty. She's the regular host of Radio Boston. Thanks for joining me. It's a little bit strange
you
to see
great
you on that
chair.
Side of the table. Thank you. Thank you. Coming from you, that means a lot. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Shira Springer, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Shira Springer. Poet Kevin Young began a new job this year as poetry editor for The New Yorker. Young directs the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture in Harlem. And in November, his latest book hit the shelves and was longlisted, even before its publication, for a National Book Award and an Andrew Carnegie Medal for Excellence. The new book is Bunk: The Rise of Hoaxes, Humbug, Plagiarists, Phonies, Post-Facts, and Fake News. He's written a dozen other books of prose and poetry. Our WBUR colleague, Kelly Horan, spoke with him earlier this month when he was in town. Young has deep roots here in Boston, and that's where the conversation began.
I'm so curious to know, reading about your late father, who was an ophthalmologist, your mother, who we can give a shout-out to the Mattapan Community Health Center, runs that, and who has a PhD in chemistry. Those seem like two kind of left-brain occupations, and here you are, a poet. How did that happen?
Wow, you'd have to ask them. I think they both are creative in their own ways, and my father's passed away, but he was very much a hobbyist. He had a million different sort of interests. He wrote a little bit of poetry. He sort of would reveal from time to time. But mainly, I think they were incredibly supportive about exploring whatever it was I was interested in. And I think they recognized creativity as one branch of that. And I think being well-rounded was something they always emphasized, which I really appreciated. I like to say, too, going further back, I come from a long line of preachers and musicians, and somewhere in there is poetry.
Yeah, definitely. Do you remember when the spark was ignited that turned you on to poetry and made you want to be a poet?
There were a few sparks. I mean, I think looking back, I've moved recently, so you go through boxes, and I found a cache of things I wrote when I was younger. Some were little poems, but really, in earnest, I started thinking myself as a poet probably later than I started writing poems, which was when I was 12 or 13 and took a class over the summer. By then, we were in Topeka, Kansas, which was an interesting place because Langston Hughes had lived there. Gwendolyn Brooks, the great poet, was born there. And I've learned later that there was a long tradition of poetry in Kansas. So that was really useful to me later. At the time, it was just useful to know there were other people out there in the world who wrote things, you know. And I would go to my local bookstore and just get whatever was there. So I ended up with a really eclectic reading background, which I think put me in good stead for, you know, The New Yorker. And one of the books I remember vividly getting was The New Yorker Book of Poems, this big yellow paperback edition, which I still have. And I put little check marks or notes by the poems I was really interested in.
I have the impression that you were writing all the time when you were in college. And I came across this quote from a friend of yours, Colson Whitehead, who said about you, "When most people were dabbling, he was working. He was well on his way when most of us were listening to Nirvana and wearing dirty clothes."
That's a great quote from him. He, of course, was writing great stuff, too. I'm not sure he would see it the same way, but I felt like at the time we didn't know what we were going to do, and we were kind of coming up together, and to be able to have that interchange and, you know, to be in that milieu was really rich and enriching. And obviously, Colson is one of our great writers.
It makes me really envious when I hear about it. It seems like it was just a place of intellectual foment and good friendships and cheering each other on creatively. And that's invaluable to artists.
Well, and talking about television and bad movies.
Okay, good. I'm glad to hear you did that too.
that stands artists in even better stead.
I want to talk about your book, Bunk: The Rise of Hoaxes, Humbug, Plagiarists, Phonies, Post-Facts, and Fake News. Now, I know it takes a long time to write a book, so I'm guessing you conceived of this well before fake news was a hashtag.
Yes. There were hashtags, but not fake news. It was about 6 years ago that I started really in earnest. And my previous book, The Gray Album, my previous nonfiction book, had been very much about sort of lying as an improvisatory act and something that I traced through Black culture from slavery to the present. And then I started thinking a lot about the nefarious side of lying and fakery writ large, and ended up going from Barnum to the present. And the present, which I had been thinking about a lot, and thinking about whether hoaxes specifically were getting worse, were there more of them, were we in a bad patch? Looks like we are. And, you know, that present sort of came to be as I was writing it.
We're in a bad patch, but we've been here before. And I think one of the things I was heartened by in reading your book is that we have been here before. So as bad as it feels now, somehow we recovered. and it reminds me of the way you bookend your book with at the start and the finish with the William Dean Howells quote to Edith Wharton, "What the American public always wants is a tragedy with a happy ending." So, wow, that rather seems, touches on the zeitgeist.
Seems accurate.
Yeah.
Thanks, William Dean. I think that he's tapping, I think, onto this idea that we want all the struggle and then at the end, you know, and even tragedy. It's not just, you know, struggle. And I think that my concern is the way the hoax has changed. It is true that we've had these patches before, and I start the book in the 1830s, really, and looking at the advent of the penny press. Newspapers were once a nickel, and then they became a penny, and how this affected what people read, what people saw, and it very much was filled with hoaxes. And it sounds a lot like and feels a lot like the internet. And I think that kind of mix of technology, cultural unease, I definitely think in the 1830s people were looking back and trying to, at a relatively new nation, and trying to think about what makes America and what making America great again yet again. I mean, there was this kind of way in which people were looking back, and one of the ways they did that was through the hoax.
Let's talk about that. I mean, the moon hoax, for example. Sure. Tell us what the moon hoax was and how long it was sort of carried out.
It happened in 1835, and a gentleman named Richard Adams Locke contrived a hoax in which it appeared to be someone else writing from a laboratory in South Africa, which actually was true. There was a famous astronomer, John Herschel, who was indeed there, and this was supposedly a report of seeing life on the moon. And the way it was built, it seemed very scientific. It seemed very gradual. It's like, oh, day three, I see biped beavers on the moon. And it just became the rage. People were really fascinated by it. They wanted to see it every day. It was serialized and just grew and grew, both the paper circulation, but also other papers which were vying for, you know, what's the truth here, or saying, like, we too have the inside scoop on the moon.
And I want to have you read just a short passage. It's such a beautiful passage because it speaks so perfectly to this nefarious quality that you say hoaxes take on. So if you don't mind reading, and then we'll return to it.
The moon hoax's popularity certainly owed much to its recreating on the moon what many white readers believed could be found at home. Perhaps much better. There, on the other end of a telescope, wasn't just life, but order. Not just extinct craters, but vibrant temples. Not just sustenance, but subordination. Not just humanoids, but hierarchies. Even many of those abolitionists who fought for change didn't seek to eliminate hierarchy, just slavery.
That's author Kevin Young reading from his new book, Bunk, The Rise of Hoaxes, Humbug, Plagiarists, Phonies, Post-Facts, and Fake News. And there you have it, the racial undertone of the hoax. So it goes from being biped beavers to hierarchies where at the top are the lighter skinned.
Yeah.
And at the bottom are those who resemble orangutans.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fascinating thing there. And we don't know even now, was Locke trying to satire that? Was he trying to sort of set us up to believe this thing that mirrored in a very allegorical way what was happening on Earth? Certainly its popularity had a lot to do with that, and it had a lot to do with what was imagined there. And in a way, it offered people an idea of a fresh start. You know, let's start over. And I think we have that even in our space mythologies, you know, and you can almost trace them back to the moon hoax. And some people have talked about it as early science fiction. And there were other hoaxes at the time, like Barnum's first famous hoax, where he showed a woman named Joyce Heth, who he said was George Washington's nursemaid, which would have made her 161 years old. And, you know, she too was black. She likely was enslaved. And it really spoke to a lot of the country's concerns about wanting to go back and being able to, literally, people would touch her and examine her to sort of touch George Washington, the person who touched George Washington.
You mentioned satire. And one of the things that I was wondering as I read the book is, what is the difference between satire and a hoax? How do you see it?
Well, satire is, I think, trying to mock something that we all might see or maybe can't say. And the hoax is often trying to trick us into believing something that isn't true. So it's a fascinating kind of form. I do think there's a difference between a prank and a hoax, if only in duration. And a prank is meant to be caught, and a hoax sometimes is trying its best not to be. But it always has these clues and giveaways in it.
And I think it also relies on the willingness, whether knowing or not, of those to be hoaxed. You know, it's the impassive listener.
Right.
I mean, reader.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. I think that I started the book thinking a lot about why we deceive each other. And I ended up thinking about why we believe and why do we have this need to believe, especially, I think, starting in the 20th century, the worst about each other. The moon hoax, at least, is trying to kind of honor this idea of the moon as this wondrous place and the world as a wondrous place. I think now you see more that tragedy than even that happy ending. And that tragic quality of the hoax, its emphasis on horror and on pain, is the one that I see all around us. And we see it all around us now. I was just in D.C., and I happened to be in the place where Pizzagate happened. And that was, it was wild to go in there and see it, A, and B, to realize that this was the place where people claimed there were a sex ring and pedophilia. And thinking about it as a hoax, if we step back, it's very much, again, this tragic, painful place. It's not imagining wonders on the moon. It's imagining the worst possible things on Earth. And why is that happening is one of the questions in my book.
We are in this cultural moment when some don't wish to believe what's true and where what's fake has such appeal to so many, and it's muddied everything. Arguably, it's helped elect a president who himself is a latter-day P.T. Barnum, but of perhaps a more nefarious sort, depending on what you think. What do you think about that thesis?
Well, I think that the danger is what I call a half-hoax world, where nothing is really quite ever true. Everything is just a little bit fake. And that can start to seem pervasive. My worry by the end of the book, which I finished last fall, is that we've entered a whole hoax world, one in which nothing is ever true and everything is fake. Now, the danger there, I think, is the difference between cynicism and skepticism. And to me, being skeptical is something our journalists should do and something that we, I think, as active listeners and participants should do. We should think about our sources and our places we're getting our information. But also at the same time, if you end up thinking nothing is real, everything is fake, then you end up in a really cynical place that I think leads to hoaxes, ironically. It leads to more fakery, because you can kind of put things over on someone who just says, oh, it's all fake anyway, so why not? I think that's the troubling question now is, in Barnum's day and in Locke's day, what I think the penny press did and the hoaxes did is they made us all experts. We could, you know, say, oh, I think that's real or not. And now there's a worry that there are no experts. You know, it's just all up for grabs.
Well, now, you've done all the research. You've done the history. Here we are at the end of this wild year, by any measure.
Yeah.
If past is prologue, what do we have to look forward to? Give me something good and give me something
real. The happy ending? You are an American.
I am. If the tall tale is an American literary form, I want to know, what do we have to look forward to? And I would like a little bit of a happy ending. No pressure.
I don't have an exact happy ending. I think, though, that we can see with, you know, because one of the things I trace is journalistic hoaxes, which are many of them from Barnum to Stephen Glass now, or relatively recently. And I think that what we've seen with, you know, Times Person of the Year, the real revelations of sexual misconduct, assault, and the quick effect that has had on our culture and reshaping the dialogue, all of which starts with journalism, I think is really an interesting, hopeful sign, as troubling as it may be. I think we are in a moment where we can't just simply dismiss that news as fake. Many, many people, many of these people are women, have experienced and believe this and know it to be true. And many of the men who know and care for them have thought this along the way, but many, many are surprised. And that sort of divide in our culture is something the hoax typically has made use of. I very much trace this division as a kind of labor the hoax does. And that seems to me a sign of these divisions being, if not healed, then addressed. And that's my hope, is that we will start to think about these divisions that lurk behind the hoax and fix those.
That's poet and New Yorker poetry editor Kevin Young. Our colleague Kelly Horan spoke with him earlier this month about his new book, Bunk: The Rise of Hoaxes, Humbug, Plagiarists, Phonies, Post-Facts, and Fake News. That's it for today. Seriously warm wishes for a happy and healthy new year. Our show is produced by Kathleen McNerney, Jamie Bologna, and Allison Bruzek, with help from Cassandra Sunt, Lily Tyson, and Zoe Mitchell. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Shira Springer, and this is Radio Boston.